This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Ray Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America. Ray Offenheiser is here today to discuss the work of Oxfam and tell us about the GROW campaign, an effort to fix the food system and help end hunger. Welcome, Ray.
Nice to be with you, Diane.
Would you begin by saying a few words about Oxfam, your history, vision, and mission?
Well, Oxfam is an international humanitarian and development organization, and we were founded in Great Britain during the Second World War really to provide assistance to refugees literally during the war in Greece and then later after the war in war-torn Europe. And then looking a little bit beyond that into the newly independent states in the post-war period, I represent Oxfam America, which was founded here in the United States in 1971 as a response to the Bangladesh famines, which probably many of your listeners remember from the very famous song from the Beatles about Bangladesh and the great concert that happened in Madison Square Garden in support of that, you know, the people of Bangladesh during that famine period. So we've been around, based in Boston, for the last 40 years or so. Our work has sort of three dimensions to it. One is we're one of the first responders to these major humanitarian emergencies around the world. So you'll find us in Darfur, the Eastern Congo today, where there's fighting going on and there's a lot of disruption and people are at risk. And in Haiti, of course, in the aftermath of the earthquake. So many of those places, we're on the ground providing relief, life-saving relief to people. We also do long-term development work in communities around the world, dealing with issues of agriculture, education, health, and so forth. And what many of our listeners may not know is Oxfam, our board made a decision many years ago not to take U.S. government money, but rather to be a very strong voice in Washington on U.S. foreign and development policy. So we probably have the largest public policy office in Washington dealing with issues that have to do with development, humanitarian relief, aid reform, and a variety of other issues that are relevant in the development field today.
Would you say more about the overall approach of Oxfam to addressing poverty, hunger, and social injustice? What is your strategy?
Well, one thing that's always characterized Oxfam that I think has been a bit different than other organizations in our field is we've always believed that it's been important for us to work ourselves out of a job. And that what we should really be doing is working on building self-reliant communities in the developing world. And our approach to that has been to work largely through indigenous not-for-profit organizations. So we've spent a lot of time funding and building and assisting and accompanying indigenous not-for-profits in their struggles to actually represent their populations in their country. So presently, Oxfam supports between 4,000 to 5,000 not-for-profit organizations in the developing world. So our footprint on the ground tends to be a bit lighter, but we'll tend to have a whole range of partner organizations that are doing very exciting work in their national context. I think the other thing that I think we've learned over the years is that in addressing critical poverty issues, we've realized that you can't solve problems exclusively at the local level. You need to actually be thinking about, are there policy and institutional constraints that really limit the ability of poor communities to access opportunity and assets they need to really solve the kinds of problems that they're facing? So we've adopted, if you will, a human rights approach, and we, in effect, champion social, economic, and cultural rights as a kind of core aspect of the work we do. And what that means is we'll challenge institutional behavior where we think it may be impeding the ability of poor communities to advance.
Let's talk now about the GROW campaign. First, what is the goal?
Well, basically, the GROW campaign came out of the fact that in 2008, there was a global food price crisis. And we sort of woke up one morning and discovered that around the world, food prices were increasing some 350%. And literally, there were 38 countries where there were riots around the world in capital cities, and it really destabilized these countries to a very significant degree. And we realized that the global community had not been really paying attention to agricultural productivity. We had been underinvesting in the sector. We'd assumed that there was going to be cheap, abundant food in the global markets for the foreseeable future. And we woke up one morning and the stocks were low and the prices were high. And nobody was really asking, well, how did we get to that place? So what the GROW campaign is really about is our effort to try to educate the public about how do we get into that situation. What is the situation now? Are we any better off? And have we solved the problem? The answer to that is really we haven't. There are some deep structural policy issues that we've got to address if we're going to solve the problem. And the GROW campaign is really an effort to educate people about what the core issues are that need to be addressed and how they can get involved and make a difference.
Before we go into more detail, would you give a brief overview of the five priorities of your GROW campaign?
Sure. Well, the core priorities of the GROW campaign are quite simple, I think. One of them is basically to provide more investment and support to small farm communities around the world. One of the things that we learned after 2008 was there'd been a massive divestment of funds in agriculture in general, But despite the fact that the poor and the marginalized populations are largely small farmer populations, those communities were receiving very little investment at all, and that we needed to kind of up investment in agriculture and focus that investment on small farmers. So that's one of the core principles. A second thing that we realized was that with the sort of global economic collapse, it was a very strange thing that happened, which was there were large volumes of money that were not finding it profitable to be in the stock market. And they started sort of drifting off into other places, like, for example, speculating on food commodity pricing. And actually, this had the effect of driving prices up and increasing volatility in the food markets around the world. Well, you know, that might be beneficial for investors, but it might not be particularly good for poor communities living overseas that have to pay very high prices for food. So this whole question of trying to figure out how we deal with speculation is a second element. One of the other things we were focused on is the whole issue of modernizing U.S. food aid programs. The United States provides 50% of the food aid that's given annually for emergency relief. It's a very antiquated and inefficient system. It needs reform and overhaul, and the taxpayers could get better value for dollar if that reform took place. We also discovered that in the United States, since 2000, the amount of the corn crop going into our gas tanks went from 10% to 40%. And the fact that we're displacing corn from the food supply into our gas tanks has actually had the effect of lessening the amount of corn in the global market, therefore also increasing prices. And yet we're not getting the climate change benefit, the carbon sequestration benefit that we thought we would be getting from that. And so we're looking at that whole issue. And then finally, one of the things that happened again after 2008 was many countries became very concerned about whether they could feed their own populations from their own land base. And they did not want to face rioting of the sort they saw in 2008. So we saw a lot of movement of money into Africa, particularly in other areas where there might be land surplus, in pursuit of land grabs and water grabs, to other countries and financial interests trying to secure asset bases of land and water, displacing poor populations. And so trying to address that land grab question is one of the final bits of the policy aspects of the campaign.
How do you see climate change affecting the ability to reduce food insecurity and interfacing with your priorities?
Well, climate change is sort of the big looming issue that casts a big shadow over all of these various policy questions. And what we see as a humanitarian organization working in countries around the world, Oxfam's in probably about 95 countries, is that in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, we used to see drought cycles that would run from 7 to 8 years. There would be a drought and there wouldn't be another one for 7 or 8 years. Now we see them every 3 years. And you see them in the news, but you may not be aware that we're seeing them more frequently. You also see the kind of rainstorms, the weather events of the sort that we saw in New York with Sandy, you know, with increasing frequency. So if it's not a drought, it might be rain or irregular rain wiping out sort of agricultural productivity. So what we're realizing is we need to be invested in what's called climate adaptation or climate resilience programming with communities and with countries around the world, where we're having an open conversation about the fact that climate change is here, it's real, it's having an impact on agricultural systems and productivity, and we need to find ways to climate-proof agriculture, thinking about new technologies, new seeds, and new ways of managing water supply and so forth so that communities can deal with these climate shocks.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Ray Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America. Our topic is Oxfam's GROW campaign to fix the food system and help end hunger. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Among the priorities that you mentioned, where are you currently placing your emphasis?
Well, right now, Oxfam is focusing a bit on this question of land grabs and trying to kind of organize and educate the public about the fact that, you know, that this issue has a real impact on small farmer communities around the world. And we're basically trying to get major institutions like the World Bank and other investor groups to be thinking a little bit more about where is their money going and is it going out to investments in land and water in developing countries in ways that could be harmful to those populations. Our interest here is not to be, if you will, anti-investment. It's actually to try to get the global community to be thinking about the consequences of these kinds of investments on these poor communities and whether they're actually going to be beneficial or not, and to put that out in the public domain and help people connect the dots. And so we're doing some public education around that issue. And we're being joined by quite a number of other organizations that actually are witnessing similar kinds of problems on the ground in countries where they're working.
Would you say more specifically about what's taking place?
Well, we're seeing this phenomenon where, say, countries in Africa are finding that, for example, there might be an investor group from Saudi Arabia that comes in and says, we would like to lease 10,000 acres or 15 to 20,000 acres of land for 100 years, and we'd like it to be well irrigated, and we're going to pay you this much money to sort of access that land. And in that particular case, the country, without any consultation necessarily with its citizens, will negotiate that deal. Now, there are countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, where they have historically had what you call center pivot agriculture, relying on deep aquifers of water to produce grains in Saudi Arabia. What's happened now is they've drained the aquifers and they don't have adequate water. So they've undermined the sustainability of their own agricultural system. So now they're going around trying to figure out where can they actually locate agricultural investments to feed their population outside of their own national borders. And there's other countries that just have land deficits. For example, like say a Korea or a Taiwan, and they've got a growing population and they're trying to figure out, you know, how to meet the needs of that population on a land base that's outside of their own country. And in some other cases, you have actually commercial interests and pension funds and sovereign wealth funds that are actually going into these areas as well, going into the sort of land investment area, because I think the perception is as we go forward toward 2050, when we're going to have to feed 9 billion people, land, agricultural land, and investment in agriculture is going to be a good business. And people are positioning themselves now either as nations and or as companies to be in a position to actually profit from that. But that has real consequences for communities on the ground who may have title to that land, sometimes individual, sometimes collective title, and where those titles and their particular long-term interests are being compromised.
You mentioned that you're doing an education campaign around this issue, but also are you speaking with decision makers who might actually be able to make changes?
Indeed, we are. We're in dialogue with people at the World Bank and in the international financial institutions. They've actually put this issue on the map themselves. There's been studies that have been done actually by the World Bank on the question, and they're on record as having recognized that it's an issue. And we're talking about this issue within the sort of G8 and G20 context. And we're organizing sort of a variety of different not-for-profit organizations to work toward dialogue with the private sector companies to get them to sort of be conscious of this as they're making their investments on the ground. And I think they're very aware and sensitive to the fact that to get involved in these situations where what they perceive as a long-term investment could be compromised by a pushback from citizens could compromise that investment. So I think there's a lot of sensitivity to the issue. There's some global debates going on that are creating, if you will, normative standards for what might be a good investment in agriculture versus one that would actually compromise the interests of poor populations on the ground. So I think we're making some progress.
Let's talk now about the ways that U.S. food aid needs to be modernized. What are the issues around that priority?
Well, food aid, first of all, I think it's really important for your listeners to realize, you know, that this is one area that has been really important for U.S. foreign aid, and Americans have been extraordinarily generous as a nation in supporting needy populations all over the world. And we provide 50% of the food aid that's contributed globally, which is quite a significant symbol of our generosity as a nation. That being said, there are a number of sort of conditions under which that aid is provided that I think are questionable today and that we ought to be tackling. One is that basically all the food that we provide through aid has to be purchased from U.S. farmers. And then it has to be shipped on U.S. ships or U.S. bottoms, as they call it. And the difficulty with this is we end up spending a lot of money on the shipping of this food to where it might be needed. The other problem with that is oftentimes when you have these food emergencies, people need the food tomorrow. And it could take 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months for that food to get there when it's shipped from U.S. ports, going through the Great Lakes and then to Africa or whatever the location might be. What we've discovered and the humanitarian community has discovered is that we can generally, in probably just about every case you can think of, buy food cheaply and buy it locally, or if not locally, we can buy it regionally. And if not in the country where the crisis is, we can buy it next door and we can get it there within 24, 48, 72 hours. And so there's been proposals that have been put before Congress, both under the Bush administration and the Obama administration. So this is a bipartisan issue. It started with the Bush administration, to their credit, to actually devote 25%. The Bush proposal was 25% of the money that we spend to buy food aid commodities in the United States be devoted to local purchase. So that's the core proposition, with the idea that 25% would get more food there quicker, cheaper than the food coming from the U.S. That could be complemented by the other 75% being spent on food coming from U.S. producers. So that would get us greater efficiencies. And now the American taxpayer is only getting 50 cents on the dollar for every dollar they spend actually being used to purchase food. The other 50% is just buying space and ships and gasoline to run them. So we would be saving that money and we'd be getting the food there faster and more efficiently.
Would you speak now about your ethanol priority?
Well, ethanol, as I said earlier in the early introductory remarks, has become a big issue in the U.S. because we had congressionally mandated subsidies to basically kind of build the industry. And to some degree, there's kind of an interesting paradox here, or irony, I suppose you could say, in that the initial impulse here was that putting ethanol in gas tanks was actually going to be energy efficient, and it was also going to reduce carbon in the atmosphere. But what we've learned subsequently is to get from corn to ethanol releases carbon that basically counteracts the sort of positive effects of it. And then we've also realized that we have, for the first time in history, created a link between energy and agriculture, in which the amount of food we're displacing from the food supply is actually increasing the costs of food to the consumer. And because of the volume of food that comes from the United States, it affects the global marketplace rather significantly. So the objective here really is to try to break this link between energy and food and basically look maybe to the future and think about, if we're going to use ethanol in our gas tanks, can we think about second or third generation biofuels that are not food-based? And there's a lot of research going on in this area. But in the short term, I think we've got to realize that Congress has passed legislation that subsidizes the growth of the industry on the one hand, subsidizes the oil companies to blend the 10% of ethanol into our gas. And Congress has also passed mandates that would increase that 10% of ethanol mix to 15%, which would actually encourage corn contribution to our gas to increase from 40%, perhaps to even a higher percentage. So we're really after cut the subsidies for growing the industry, diminish the amount of ethanol in our gas tanks that's corn-based, invest in research for next-generation biofuels, and reduce, if not eliminate, the mandates that require the 10 to 15% mix today.
Would you say more about what you're doing at the legislative level to try to change some of these ethanol policies?
The good news on this issue was that because of the budget crisis, in the last budget round, in the debates around the ag bill and the energy issues, the subsidies for the ethanol industry were cut somewhat. So I think we've made some progress on that front, and we've been active in trying to promote that. The one piece that remains that I think is a big challenge are the mandates, the 10% and 15% mandates. And I think that's really where we've got to focus our attention in the near term, is basically to see if we can reduce or eliminate those mandates. And I think we're not against a biofuel solution that actually can diminish carbon in the atmosphere. That would be actually positive for climate change, but we've got to invest in the research to get there. And so some more aggressive financing for that kind of research would be positive.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Ray Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America. Our topic is Oxfam's Grow campaign to fix the food system and help end hunger. Would you now say what steps you're planning to take to try to end excessive speculation in agricultural commodities, one of your other priorities?
Well, this is a tricky one because it's one that I think for most of the public, it's kind of hard to understand. But the simple way to think about it is, you know, if you've got $1 million and you have to make a choice between maybe a reasonably low investment in the stock market versus the potential for a higher return investing in corn futures in the commodity markets, and you think that's a relatively safe investment, then you might move your money there. And what we've seen is we've seen money moving from the equities markets into the commodities market. So that's the first thing to understand. Oftentimes, though, this is in sort of what you might call those future markets or the hedge fund arena, where a lot of this is not necessarily altogether transparent. And so part of what we're after here is maybe greater transparency in the funding flows so that we can actually evaluate the impact of these funding flows on the potential for creating negative impacts in food pricing. A couple of years ago, when we were in the midst of this food price crisis, there was a large plenary at the World Bank to discuss this. And when asked about this issue, Bob Zoellick, the head of the World Bank at that time, made a very interesting comment, which was, you know, we know that this kind of speculation has a boost effect on global food prices, but because the movement of this money is not tracked within the market so that we can actually see it, it's very hard for us to get data and actually evaluate the impact. So what we're actually pushing for is legislation that would make the kind of market investments in this speculative kind of economy much more transparent, and therefore we were able to track the potential impacts and evaluate whether we need policy remedies for that or not.
Does there seem to be receptivity to making this kind of change?
I think it's early days on that one because we're still in quite a tough discussion in Washington around more fundamental issues that have to do with these energy questions and investment in agriculture. And given the budget crisis, it's been a tough time to even sort of get closure on, if you will, adequate investments in the agricultural sector programming of AID itself. So this is one, I think, where we need to be investing more time in education and trying to figure out what the appropriate legislative remedies might be.
Well, we have one more priority we haven't gotten to yet, which is investing in small-scale food producers. What specifically are you doing in this area?
the small-scale food producer, if you will, these are the heroes and heroines of agriculture all over the world. These are the people who produce in local communities and feed tens of thousands, if not millions, of people around the world, and who get very little credit for that. And one of the ironies, I think, in the global food system, when we look at it, is that very often these are the people who live and die on the land in producing food, but oftentimes they are undernourished themselves because they've not been able to kind of increase productivity and they've not been able to kind of realize the sort of potential that even their land and assets would allow. So what we're really arguing for here is the possibility that as we think about a return to significant investment in agriculture globally, that the small farmer be given some priority. And when I say a return to significant investment, let me just, for your listeners, give a little bit of a sketch of what I'm talking about. Back in the 70s, when we were at the peak of the Green Revolution, and agriculture and food security and hunger were top of mind, we had the big famines in Africa and that sort of brought this to mind, and the Bangladesh famine that I mentioned earlier. The World Bank and USAID were investing something like 40% of their funding portfolios in agriculture, and a lot of it was directed at small farm agriculture. When the food price crisis hit in 2008, the investment levels at the World Bank and USAID were at 4% for agriculture. We had literally just forgotten about agriculture. And yet here we had this dramatic food crisis. And it just brought to mind to everybody that how can we literally be thinking about everything else but feeding this global population and actually have slept through the fact that we had diminished stocks in the global marketplace and that now we had to kind of revitalize agricultural institutions. We had to think about technology and so forth. So the idea here is let's get some money back in agriculture at a significant level. Let's think about this forgotten sector of, you know, literally billions of small farm producers. Let's think about investments in technology and markets and infrastructure that will actually help them produce and get their product to market, get a better return, cash return on their investments, and basically be able to feed themselves off their own farms and or be able to buy affordable food in the marketplace. And I think that will get us a long way toward addressing the food and hunger problems around the world.
Next year, in 2013, there will be a second Obama administration and a new Congress. What do you see as the political climate for Oxfam's priorities?
Well, the Obama administration, you know, even during the first term, in terms of the development priorities it had put forward, basically it had three core priorities. One of them was, you know, investments in global health and continuation of the work on HIV/AIDS and complementing that with investment in addressing other critical diseases that are commonly found in tropical regions of the world. So that's critical, and the administration's committed to that. The second big priority actually was what's called the Feed the Future Initiative, which is the initiative in which the administration would be contributing to the Global Fund for Food Security that's managed by the World Bank to address this sort of global food crisis. It would be investing in much more work with small farmers on the ground in countries around the world through a partnership model. And it would be keeping our food aid levels at a substantial volume. So all of that's good within the second priority. And then the third priority is addressing the issue of climate change. The signal seemed to be that the administration wants to continue with these three priorities. I think the tough thing is whether in this current fiscal environment, we can protect our foreign aid investments and really make a difference in that area. And here in the Washington area, Senator Patricia Murray is going to have a significant role in all of this because of her leadership now as chair of the Budget Committee in the Senate. And so one of the things where I think all of us are focused on is the appropriation process, protection of the accounts for international development and diplomacy as this whole debate on the fiscal cliff and deficit reduction goes forward. And there's a critical debate that's going to be taking place over the next several months while we're hearing all this narrative about the fiscal cliff. What's happening sort of in a more practical way is there's a discussion on appropriations and budget, and not only for this fiscal year, but they're trying to figure out if they're going to solve the deficit problem, they have to come up with bills that actually represent a longer-term solution. So we may be locking in longer-term solutions to these problems in the way we solve the deficit issue that may determine what we're going to be investing in development in the future. So all of us are watching that very closely, and she will be playing a very important role.
Beyond appropriations, what specific pieces of legislation and or administrative policies will be at the top of your list in the upcoming year?
Well, Oxfam continues to be a very active voice in Washington around some of the big humanitarian crises. So, for example, for something like 40 years, we've been present on the ground in Sudan, and we're very keen to sort of ensure that peace is secured in Sudan and that there is, you know, meaningful reconciliation between North and South, that the combatant groups are disarmed, and that that country, which is critical to peace and security in Central Africa, shift from sort of a crisis mode to one in which they're investing in long-term development. In addition, Oxfam has been very involved in the whole area of extractive industries and the impacts of oil, gas, and mining on developing countries around the world. We're interested in that because we think it has tremendous potential for generating revenue for countries that they can invest in positive development outcomes. But we're also concerned about sometimes the negative, if you will, resource curse effects of windfall revenue on democracy in these countries. And so we've been pushing legislation that deals with transparency of these revenue flows, with the idea that with greater levels of transparency, citizens can take action and can get better outcomes. And there's legislation on Capitol Hill to that effect as well that we've worked with Senators Lugar and Cardin on over the last several years.
What do you see as the relative opportunity in working with private companies to try to bring about Oxfam's priorities?
Well, I think one of the interesting things for us has been we've realized over the last several years that there's a bit of a sea change going on in the world in terms of how the private sector is seeing new markets and their role and presence in those new markets. And there's also a change in the sort of proportion of, if you will, monies going into these countries, even some of the poorest countries in Africa, that come from aid versus foreign direct investment from private sources. So it used to be that many countries, most of the incoming flow of funds were from development finance, from bilateral aid or multilateral aid from the UN. Now we're seeing that completely flip. And foreign aid as a percent of foreign direct investment is declining radically. So we realized we had to be working much more with private sector companies in dialogue around what are their investment plans and challenging them to ask, is their work going to be pro-development, pro-poor, pro-environment, if you will, or not? And so we've developed a whole private sector team that basically does that kind of work. And we're sort of operating on, if you will, three or four different levels. One is at the highest level, there are a lot of different global institutions that are creating new normative standards for how extractive industries, for example, should comport themselves in developing countries in terms of protecting environmental standards or ensuring appropriate compensation for affected populations or engaging in transparent financial transactions with governments around, you know, the funding flows, all of which is with the purpose of ensuring that if they're going to have a presence in countries, that it's going to have a positive effect. I think maybe the good news is that many of the vanguard or global companies are really thinking a lot about the fact that there's no place on earth they can hide anymore because of the internet, and that they've got to be good corporate citizens. And they're trying to think through with organizations like Oxfam how to do that. And so we're finding the doors in many cases are open to us to go in and talk to these companies about their supply chains, how those supply chains are working. Some companies are asking us to actually in some sense evaluate their supply chains in terms of positive and negative effects on environment and labor and gender issues and so on and so forth. So there's sort of a new day, if you will, particularly I would emphasize with the leading corporations that are thinking along these lines.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
What I'd like to leave your listeners with is the idea that there is still a global food security challenge in the world, that it's important that people understand that it's got a variety of different critical structural and systemic issues that need to be addressed that are sort of big picture and require policy remedies. They can learn about those issues by joining the GROW campaign with Oxfam at www.oxfamamerica.org. Just look for the GROW campaign. We think it's really important that citizens who care about this food challenge. And again, I would underline that we're going to be a world with 9 billion people by 2050. We're 7 billion today. To feed that 9 billion people, we're going to have to do things differently. We're going to have to think a lot more about sustainability. We're going to have to think about how we manage our own lives, how much energy we consume, what food products we consume, whether we're consuming seasonally, whether we sort of are wasting food. So there's things we can do in our personal lives, but there's also things we can do in policy arena. And the GROW campaign, I think, provides them that opportunity. So I would just encourage people to join us, and hopefully we're providing the information they'll need to be effective citizens in their own community on these issues.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Ray.
It's been a real delight, Diane. Thank you so much.
You have just been listening to Ray Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America. For more information, check on the web at www.oxfamamerica.org. Again, that's oxfamamerica.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.